What's up, everybody? I am Wyndham Jennings. This is Celluloid Fever Dreams, and you are listening. The listener. There's got to be a better word for that. But anyway, this is episode, honestly, I don't know at this point. The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas episode was 69, which, of course, I'm going to remember that one. So this one's 70-something. I'll put it in the show notes if you're really, you know, that interested in what the number, what the episode number is. This is still season 3, and we're going to try this again. I know I came back and did 2 episodes last time, but honestly, at that point, I wasn't in as good a place as I thought I was, and I was doing it more out of, feeling like I needed to, rather than because I wanted to. And since then, I'm in a better place. I've found a love of watching movies again. I'm back playing games again, socializing more, and reached a point where I want to do this again. So hopefully we'll finish out season 3 and continue on with a season 4. And honestly, weirdly, the thing that got me back into it and sort of reignited my love of watching movies was the Dungeons & Dragons film. Judging by the box office, I think I was the only person who went to see it in the theaters. But I fell in love with it. It reminded me so much of the adventure films from the 80s. You know, the mixture of humor and the action. The whole mixture was a good, fun film. And you don't have to know anything about the Dungeons & Dragons to watch the movie. I might, if people want it, do an episode on it. If you guys want me to, hit me up on Twitter. If you're still on there, if not, I'm on TikTok as well. You can just leave a message on the little excerpts that I post for the episodes on there, or you can email me at celluloidfeverdreams@gmail.com. But it's not spelt correctly because somebody already had it spelt the way it's supposed to be spelt. So celluloid is CellUloid. But Fever Dreams is still spelt the same. Besides Dungeons & Dragons, I also got 4 months of Mubi for $4. If you hadn't checked them out, I mean, I don't know if you can find a deal for it. I'd suggest checking it out, especially if you're into foreign films or sort of offbeat films. I've really enjoyed a lot of the stuff I found on there. I started watching The Kingdom, which is a 3-season hospital drama by Lars von Trier from the mid-90s. And I've watched the first season, and it's just one of the most completely bizarre. I've almost got whiplash from some of the tonal shifts because the episodes, I'm not sure if I'm watching a workplace comedy or if I'm watching a psychological horror or a supernatural horror, or if I'm just watching some sort of surrealist mashup of all of those. I'm pretty sure the last one's the more correct one. But if you have Mubi or if you can find another way to watch this, I kind of recommend it. I finished the first season, and I'm sort of trying to gear myself up for the second season so that I can take all of it in. To give you an idea of what I mean by the tonal shifts, there's a storyline where a woman is trying to figure out why there are ghosts haunting the hospital. There's also workplace comedy. There's a new head of the doctors. I can't remember what the title is. It's all in Danish and subtitled. Who just absolutely hates working in Denmark. He's originally from Sweden. And so he goes every night at the end of his shift up onto the roof and screams about how much he hates Denmark and the people who live there. And then there's a romantic storyline where this two young doctors fall in love, and at first she doesn't want to pursue a relationship because she finds out she's pregnant with her ex. And over the course of the 4-episode first season, you find out that her ex is one of the ghosts that's haunting the hospital. And that's as far as I'm going to tell you. It's one of those things you kind of have to watch to really see how bizarre he got with it. But this is literally the first thing I've ever watched from Lars von Trier. So I'm kind of curious to go and watch some of his films and just see how crazy they get. Also, finally got my daughter to sit down with me and watch The Dark Crystal. I'd always wanted to expose her to the films I grew up watching. And she watched Labyrinth with her mother. And then when she's over here with me, I got her to, we sat down and watched Dark Crystal, and she really enjoyed it. I actually took her to the theater, talking about movies I loved when I was growing up. Theater around here does throwback Sundays or flashback Sundays, where they'll have an old movie in theaters for one night on a matinee and then a night showing for Sunday nights. And a couple of months ago, they did Jurassic Park, the original. And I was like, I want you to see it. And if we got a chance to see it on the big screen, you're going to go see it. I think I enjoyed it a little more than she did, but she did seem to enjoy it. Told me she did anyway. I mean, we talked about it afterwards. I also got excited because I finally tracked down one of my, like, holy grail films. Like, a film I wasn't even sure existed on DVD, and I'm pretty sure it doesn't exist on Blu-ray, or no, there's not a 4K restoration. And Mother, Jugs, and Speed, which is a mid-70s comedy about a private ambulance service starring Harvey Keitel, Raquel Welch, and Bill Cosby. Because Cosby's in it, I'm not really sure if I should do an episode of the podcast about it. I remember watching it several times when I was a kid. It would be on TV, and I think my dad rented it a couple of times when you had video stores and VHS. But yeah, I stumbled across a DVD copy of it to add it to my collection. I haven't sat down and watched it. I only just got it a couple of days ago. But if enough people, you know, contact me or in some way or another and want me to do an episode on it, I'm open to it. I'm definitely going to watch it again, but it's up to you guys whether I review a Bill Cosby film, especially one that's pushing 50 years old at this point. So, all right, I've wasted enough time with going off on tangents, but this week's film is Gross Point Blank, which was released in 1997. If you're a fan of the podcast, you know that my favorite era of films tends to be the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Well, and the 80s too, because that's growing up. You know, those were the films that I caught on TV. You know, I grew up where we had, on local television, we had a couple of hosts that would show bad movies on Saturday afternoons, things like that. And, you know, I'm also of the age when there's only three channels, it wasn't sports. You could usually find a movie playing on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. Never a good film, but you could guarantee you could find a film watching, you know, to watch on there. But I got to say, like, the mid to late 90s and a few, you know, the first few years of the 21st century, it was another one of those, like, special eras. There just seemed to be, I don't know, like, risks being taken again and films that just diverse, honestly. Can I think of a better word to describe that era? And if you didn't go through it, but you have things, you know, like Titanic, you know, have these big dramas, and you have films like this, which, let's be honest, if you tried to make Gross Point Blank nowadays, it would probably be not some big studio release, but some indie company, probably straight to Blu-ray or probably a Netflix original. So what is the plot of the film? Well, John Cusack plays Martin Q. Blank, who stands up his prom date, joins the army, and 10 years later is an international hitman who is contacted to return to his hometown for his 10-year high school reunion. The only reason he shows up is he has a target in the area, and he figures he can use the reunion as a cover story. He has to not only try to reconcile with the girl he stood up 10 years ago, but he's also got a rival hitman who's going after the same target and isn't afraid to take Martin out, if that's what it means, what's what he has to do in order to get to the target himself. I'm just going to be honest with you. I like John Cusack. I've loved every movie I've ever seen him in. Yes, even The Raven, in which he played Edgar Allan Poe trying to solve a murder. Now, if you're sitting there thinking, John Cusack, I never really thought of John Cusack as an action star. I haven't either. Of course, never thought of Michael Cera as an action star, but he did Scott Pilgrim, which is a film I really enjoyed. But for some reason around this time, they decided that they was going to try to make John Cusack into an action star. Besides this film, he also had a role in Con Air. And I remember seeing a trailer a few months ago where he's in a Western as a gunslinger. But honestly, outside of this film, I just do not buy John Cusack as an action star or as a tough guy. I think it's because in this film, he's essentially playing the characters he's known for, the sort of neurotic, control freak type characters. In fact, there's actually a fan theory that says that this film is an unofficial sequel to Say Anything, which is probably the film a lot of people, especially my age, know John Cusack from. That, you know, at the end of that film, he joined the army and, you know, then, you know, become a sniper and everything like that. So that apparently, you know, Martin Q. Blank is really supposed to be Lloyd Dobler. You know, do I believe that? Of course I don't. But I do get what they're saying. You know, the reason I believe I'm willing to buy John Cusack as an international hitman who was trained by our government to be a killer is because the character plays into the roles that he's known for and then adds that on to it. Kind of like the way that, again, I'm going to go back to Scott Pilgrim, that it's believable for Michael Cera to do the things he does in that film because the central character is still a character that we're used to seeing him play. And it's just some little extra bits thrown on that sort of feed off of that character that we know him for. While we're talking about Cusack, let's go ahead and throw out his first film was Class in 1983. And of course, you know, I mentioned a couple of films he's been in. Some other things you may recognize him from is 16 Candles, Better Off Dead, Tapeheads, Say Anything, which I've mentioned, The Road to Wellville, Being John Malkovich, which is a film I probably need to talk about on the podcast, High Fidelity, which I absolutely loved him in, 1408, Igor, Hot Tub Time Machine, and Never Grow Old. The girl he stood up is played by Minnie Driver. Character's name is Debbie Newberry. Minnie Driver, of course, has been in the films like God on the Rocks, The House of Elliot, Circle of Friends, Sleepers, Good Will Hunting, Hard Rain. She did the voice of Jane in the Disney film Tarzan, Ella Enchanted, Chevalier, Rosaline. I like Minnie Driver. I haven't seen everything she's been in, but I've always liked her. I like her as an actress. To me, though, I think the thing that really, because it seemed like she did a few films around this time and just kind of disappeared for a while, but I think she kind of fell victim because it, you know, in the late 90s, it just seemed like they threw so many actresses and actors, if we're being honest, but I'll talk about this, actresses out there to try to be the next big thing. You know, you've got Minnie Driver, Reese Witherspoon started getting big in this era, Julia Stiles, Rosario Dawson, Gretchen Mol, Claire Forlani, you know, Salma Hayek started, you know, well, I mean, she's already an actress in Mexico, but, you know, she started being pushed in films around this era. And some of them, you know, are still working today, which Minnie Driver is still working today. But, you know, some of them went on to be big stars. And some of them, to me, kind of like Minnie Driver or Claire Forlani or Gretchen Mol, just kind of got lost in the shuffle, which to me is a shame because, like I said, I think Minnie Driver's a really good actress. And like John Cusack, everything I've seen her in, I've enjoyed her in, even if I didn't enjoy the rest of the film around her. And I really liked her in this film. I really love the interplay between her and John Cusack. And I really hate the fact that they didn't do more films together. There just was a, to me, a natural chemistry between them. You believed that, you know, they were high school sweethearts who had had a bad falling out and, you know, still kind of harbored feelings for each other, but didn't really want to come out and say it. You know, like I said, and her American accent, pretty good. I mean, I believe she is American. And of course, we got to talk about Martin's unhinged assistant, Marcella, played by John's real-life sister, Joan Cusack, who, of course, I'm pretty sure her two biggest roles for people who listen to this podcast, when I say Joan Cusack, are going to be Adam's Family Values, naturally, which she played Debbie, and School of Rock, opposite Jack Black. Joan was actually a Saturday Night Live cast member back in the 80s. I can't remember if she was she in the one season that everybody got fired at the end of. I can remember her doing sketches with Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo, but I can't really remember if she was in the season, the infamous season when Lorne Michaels wasn't producing it, and they wound up firing everybody on the cast, I think, except Eddie Murphy at the end of that season because the ratings were so bad and the critics' reviews were so bad. Some of the films you may recognize her from, besides the two I've mentioned, include My Bodyguard, Broadcast News, Married to the Mob, Say Anything, My Blue Heaven, a Steve Martin film that I definitely need to talk about on this podcast, Toys, Arlington Road, Toy Story 2. That's the other film. If you don't know her from, you know her voice. She's Jessie in the Toy Story films. The rival hitman named Grocer is played by Dan Aykroyd. And again, I love him and Cusack playing off of each other. Yeah, I really wish they had done another film together or two. Comedically talking, yeah, the two of them really played well off of each other. The characters did well off each other. Yeah, of course, I might be biased. I'm a huge Dan Aykroyd fan going all the way back to the 80s. You know, the Blues Brothers, Neighbors, things like that. Some other films you may recognize him from. His first role in a film was a film, Love at First Sight, in 1977. He also appeared in The Ruttles, All You Need Is Cash, which is a Spinal Tap-style mockumentary, which came out in the 70s. Of course, the John Belushi trilogy of 1941, Blues Brothers and Neighbors, Dr. Detroit, which is a film I definitely got on the list for this podcast, Ghostbusters, Spies Like Us, Great Outdoors, Driving Miss Daisy, My Girl, Exit to Eden, Evolution. The man's been in a ton of stuff, and honestly, he's one of my favorite comedic actors of all time. Jeremy Piven also has a role in the film, playing Martin's best friend from high school, who uncovers his secret during the class reunion. I didn't bother to write down anything about Jeremy Piven, not even the character's name, because honestly, it's Jeremy Piven. And if you're sitting there thinking, oh, Jeremy Piven's in this, I wonder if he's playing some kind of self-centered, douchey lech who's constantly lusting after women. Yeah. But let's be honest. I mean, with that voice and his very punchable face, if I was casting a film, it's like, you know what? I need a creepy guy that's just, you know, kind of a douche canoe and people just want to punch him as soon as they see his face. I'm casting Jeremy Piven for that. The film was written by Tom Jankiewicz, and I think I'm pronouncing that right. And this is his only writing credit. He came up with the idea after getting an invite to his own 10-year high school reunion. The rights to the script were bought, and Cusack himself, along with his friends DiVincentio, I can't read my own handwriting anymore, apparently, who also wrote High Fidelity, an American Crime Story, and the recent Hulu production Pam and Tommy, Steve Pink, who helped write High Fidelity and was also the director for the films Accepted and Hot Tub Time Machine 1 and 2, as well as working on Cobra Kai, The Santa Clarita Diet, and also on Good Mythical Morning, the Rhett and Link Buddy System show, as well as Angie Tribeca and New Girl. Both these men are high school friends of John Cusack, you know, so they've been involved with a lot of the things he's done in Hollywood over the years. The director is George Armitage, who has also done Private Duty Nurses, the Alec Baldwin and Kim Basinger film Miami Blues, and The Big Bounce. Joe Strummer, who is the lead singer for The Clash, put together the soundtrack, doing original music as well as picking a lot of the pop songs that were included on the soundtrack. That's one of the things that I really liked about this era of filmmaking. I remember going to see films and then going and buying the soundtracks. Like, I discovered a lot of bands that I still listen to today through soundtracks at the time. You know, and you don't see that a lot anymore. You might have, like, one song from a soundtrack that gets released or a pop song put on that plays in a key moment of the film. But, you know, like, you know, during this point, like, Gross Point Blank, 10 Things I Hate About You, Josie and the Pussycats, which is all original music. But you had just pop song after pop song, and the artists you'd heard of, some that maybe you hadn't heard of yet, some that may have gotten their first big hit out of a soundtrack, but you don't really see a lot of that anymore. I honestly think the last one I could sit and say soundtrack I remember buying, just because there were so many songs in the film that I wanted to have them to listen to over and over again, was Scott Pilgrim. And I'm sure it's just a royalties thing, back in the, before the internet took off, you only had to worry about, paying for the movie in the theaters and, you know, if it gets played on TV, something like HBO or Showtime or something like that, then you'll get a kickback from it or whatever. But, you know, nowadays you've got so many streaming services and Blu-rays and DVDs and just so many ways for a film to be shown. I'm sure royalties at this point is just a nightmare. And I'm pretty sure it costs so much. That's the reason we don't see soundtracks like for, you know, like we did for things like Gross Point Blank and other films from this era. You know, it's kind of a loss. I really enjoyed collecting the soundtracks and discovering new music through them. That's how I discovered the Donnas as well. Though, if I remember right, the film I remember seeing them in and their music on the soundtrack for, they were still called the Electrocutes at the time. Interestingly enough, though the film itself didn't get a sequel, the soundtrack did. The soundtrack to this movie was so popular that the studio and the record label decided to put out a second volume with more music from the film. I'm just trying to imagine that conversation. It's like, well, John, the film didn't do well enough for us to greenlight a sequel to it, if you ever wanted to do one. But you know what, the soundtrack sold so much, we're going to put out a volume two of it. You know, we're giving it a sequel and instead of the film. So we'll talk about some little behind the scenes craziness. George Armitage was only interested in directing the film if they could cut the script down to 100 pages. Cusack and his friends had taken Jankowitz's script and rewrote it into 132 pages. When Armitage asked them to cut it down, they sent back a 150-page script. Armitage himself rewrote it down to 102 pages. In subsequent interviews after the film come out, though, Armitage has said that some of the things he cut from the film, specifically lines and little gags, made it back in because there were times that he let the cast improvise. In fact, that was one of the things he said he looked for in a cast. He wanted people that could take the characters and make more of them than what was just in the script. And, you know, people that he could trust by saying, you know what, we're going to do this again and throw the script out and just, you know, just give me all what you think your character would do or say in this scene. In fact, Armitage just said he did this so much, he basically wound up shooting three films simultaneously. He said there was a version of the film that if he put it together could just be as written in the script. He said he also did a more serious, understated tone to the film, kind of leaning into the idea that he's a hitman and the film was a little darker, not as comedic, and then one that was completely over the top and a little silly. He said that most of the film that made it into the theater is the over the top and improvised takes. He also said that there were three different endings to the film before he settled on the one. He shot three different endings before he settled on the one that wound up in the final take of the film. He said that he was actually, when trying to put the ending together, said there was such negative feedback to Alec Baldwin's character's death in Miami Blues that he made the decision early on that, no, Martin is going to survive the end of this film. All right, so if you let me ramble on enough about the film, so let's go ahead and get to the heart of the matter. And the most important question of all, was it good Lord, can I not talk anymore? Was it entertaining? Yeah, I absolutely love this film. Honestly, I don't know how many times I've watched it at this point since it came out originally. It's a great cast. It's a good comedy cast. Armitage and the studio did a lot of things right in letting the actors play with the characters, you know, and trusting them enough to improvise lines. Even if it did wind up, as he said, he wound up shooting three different films. And the characters got a good chemistry between them. Everybody, you know, me watching it, I can't find, even Jeremy Piven, I can't find a bad pairing in the film. Everybody seems to have, the relationships between them are believable, even when they push them a little bit to the extreme, you know, a little bit to the sillier, funnier side of things, over the top, if you will. Especially Joan Cusack as Martin's assistant. I mean, honestly, if you want somebody to just be over the top, silly, and still believable, Joan Cusack's your woman. And she's definitely channeling a little bit of Debbie from Adam's Family in this role, and it just makes it so much better. Honestly, though, thinking back on it and looking over the cast, the actor playing, which I don't think he's in the film. You know, he's not in the film that much. The actor playing Debbie's dad, I don't know. He's all right. He's not too much in the film. He plays a pivotal role, but not a huge role. So, you know, I can overlook that. So, where did I watch Point Blank? Yeah, Gross Point Blank at? Well, I own the DVD, and I should probably upgrade, you know, to the Blu-ray or 4K. Did that with The Princess Bride here recently. And, of course, as soon as I upgrade to the Blu-ray of Princess Bride, Criterion comes out and says they're going to do a re-release of it as a 4K. And it's the week of my birthday when they're going to do it this year. So, be turning 50 and rebuying The Princess Bride, apparently. But you can watch Gross Point Blank at the time of this recording. It's currently on Tubi. And, of course, you can rent it and buy it through all the usual suspects, such as Amazon or Apple. But, yeah, if you want something that's got a little action to it, a lot of dark humor, some over-the-top characters, and, you know, Jeremy Piven and the role he was born to play. That's right, Lord Hornington McDouche-Canoe. Check this film out. Like I said, it's funny. It's not something you can probably watch around the kids, but, you know, again, it also has to deal with a government assassin who's going back home for a 10-year high school reunion. But then again, they're your kids, so your mileage may vary. So what is our next film? Well, first off, I'm not sure I'm going to go right away back to a film a week schedule. Right now I'm looking at every other week, so it won't be next week. You guys will get another episode from me, but the week after that, probably going to go back to releasing on Thursdays. So what is our next film going to be? Well, we're going to go all the way back to the 70s again, one of the greatest eras of film, for a personal favorite from 1975. That's right, we're going to be talking about a film that I cannot believe I have not done an episode on already. A movie kind of freaked me out as a kid, but I still fell in love with it. I still think it's one of the best villain designs for a horror movie I've ever seen, even to this day. Of course, we're talking about the one, the only, The Phantom of the Paradise, a disco retelling of the Phantom of the Opera story, starring Paul Williams. So that's going to wrap it up for this episode. As always, you can find me on Twitter because I'm still there because I've never bothered to find somewhere else. If you think of somewhere else you want to hear me post stuff about or talk about stuff, I'm on TikTok as well under Sea Fever Dreams. I'm on Letterboxd if you want to follow me over there and see what films I'm watching besides the ones for the podcast. I'm on there as a Sea Fever Dreams or Wyndham Jennings, Wyndham Jennings. I'm on Instagram as well, Celluloid Fever Dreams, of course. Gave you the email address at the beginning of the show, but that's going to be it for this week. Remember, there's a lot of things you can be in life. Kind is one of the better ones, especially to yourself. But until next time, I've been Wyndham Jennings, and go out and find something fun to watch. And goodbye, everybody.